down at the University of London. I just moved at the University of Toronto and started in October.
And now he's here for the faculty this summer.
Yeah, this is like a goodbye talk. So, okay, so thanks. Thanks for coming. So today I'm going to talk about some work that I did with two other people from the University of London, which is Anna Sheridan and Martina Faré. And it's also, I still work in collaboration with Stephen Bartlett from the University of Sydney. So most of what I, well, everything I'm going to talk about is, you can find reference and details in a paper in the archive that we put there recently. So my talk is separate in two parts. The first one is more mathematical, the other one is more physical. So in the first part, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show math theorem. So what I'm going to give is a general representation for any map that's covariant with respect to E reps of SU2. And I'm going to give the proof. And in the second part of the talk, I'm going to, based on this theorem, I'm going to give theorems. So I'm going to give some, I'm going to give some analysis of dynamics of Coulomb reference frame. And all those results that we can deduce from the theorem I gave in the first part of the talk. And so the first thing I'm going to do is, in the second part, is to give a definition of what a Coulomb directional reference frame means. Then I'm going to introduce moments of a Coulomb directional reference frame. And I will also generalize concept of quality and longevity of Coulomb directional reference frame. So those concepts have already been proposed, but we're going to generalize them, and we're going to describe them in function of the moments. And then I'm going to conclude, well, I'm going to finish with two examples and a conclusion. It's an open question. Okay, so let's give a short background on SU2, because some of you probably are not familiar too much with it. So SU2 is a set of all 2x2 unitary matrix with determinant ones. So why I'm interested in SU2 in particular? Because it's isomorphic up to a phase to the group of rotations, okay, in space, in a three-dimensional space. So I'm going to use the fact that actually SU2 is an E group, and that there's a corresponding Lie algebra, which is spanned by the Coulomb matrices, like X, Y, and Z. And what I'm going to consider is one of the E reps of SU2 acting on a 2J plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space. So for those who don't know what the representation is, it's just a homomorphism from the set of SU2 to the set of unitaries on that Hilbert space, 2J plus 1. Now, there's a lot of way of choosing a representation, but I'm going to just concentrate myself on the irreducible ones. So by irreducible, it just means that the space on which the image of the representation act on, okay, it's invariant under the action of the image. Whatever, there exists no other subspace that's non-trivial in which that image acts on.
Just a dumb question. Can you remind me what a group homomorphism has to preserve?
Oh, it's just standard homomorphism. Sorry, what was just what you said?
Just products and inverses.
Yes. Product. It's going to write it. So technically, if you look at the representation in the 2J plus 1 dimensional space, there is a the algebra that's associated with this representation. And the derivative of this algebra, instead of being the Pauli matrices, it's three operators that follow the same commutation relation. And the difference is that instead of being defined in a two-dimensional, instead of being like 2x2 matrix, well, they're 2j plus 1 by 2j plus 1 matrix. Okay, in physics, those operators just correspond to the angular momentum operator in three different axes. So just to make it clear, every element of the representation of a real of SU2 can be written as on an exponential form in function of the generators of the algebra. So now what do I mean by covariance with respect to SU2? So I will say that a map chi is covariant with respect to SU2 if and only if, on a state, if you apply a representation of SU2, so an element of SU2, let's say, and then you apply the map, it's the same as if you had applied the map and then apply the element of SU2. So is that clear? That's clear. Okay, so here's a term I want to prove. So let's define a map zeta such that on a state rho j here is just it just corresponds to a state of a spin in the space of 2j plus 1. Okay, I write j because in physics it's really corresponds just to a spin. And I just sum over all the three generators of the algebra. And I normalize, so this factor come here just for normalization purpose. I want zeta to be traced as early. So the theorem is that every map that is covariant with respect to EREPs of SU2 has a polynomial form with respect to that zeta. By polynomial form, I mean that it can be written as a sum of convolution of map where you apply the map like a couple of times, right? So zeta circle n is just I apply the map n times. The q n here are real coefficients, and the number of the degree it's of the form is limited by qj. There's 2j plus 1 parameters. Okay. So how do we prove this? So the first step of the proof is you take zeta and you show that it's actually covariant with respect to SU2. That's actually for some people it might be obvious. For those who it is not, you just need that zeta follow the covariant relation here. So and you know that any SU2 element can be decomposed into rotation around two axes, let's say z and y. So you just need to show that, that map is covariant over with respect to any rotation. You just need to show that it's actually covariant with respect to rotation around the z or and the y axis. Because of the symmetry of the map, well, you just need to show it for one rotation around one axis. And since the rotation around one axis map those operators in a really easy way, okay, so you just apply rotation about those operator, and you just plug what you have in the equation and you solve it, and it's actually sure that your math is correct. So pretty easy. So what this implies is that any map of this form, so any composition of the net zeta and some of the of composition, must also be covariant. Now I need to show that every covariant map can be written in that form.
Okay.
So for this, I'm just going to use the I'm going to go in the Weaver representation. So what is the Weaver representation? The trick is you take, instead of considering density matrix, now suppose that you have
what state has map in between?
Mm, sorry.
What's the map between? The zeta? Or what is zeta relevant? Or I missed the information, sorry.
Is it irrelevant? It's just this map.
Right, what's role and what's
Rho j is a state of a spin, so it's just a quantum state over a 2j plus one dimensional state. Okay, so you have your density matrix. So the trick to go into the real representation is instead of considering like matrix, well, for states, you consider vectors. So you take each column of the density matrix and you put them one above the other. Okay? And what happened to a super operator in that representation? So suppose you have a cross representation, any operator that has some cross representation in that form. Well, in the Weaver representation, you can actually represent it this way. So you see, instead of being, the super operator become linear, just become one matrix into a space of 2j plus 1 square dimension. Okay, to prove this, it's like some. You just need to do some calculation. So now, what is the covariance criteria in the Liouville representation? Actually, it turned out that, just from the previous slide, you can deduce that the if a map Z is covariant with respect to SU2, then in the Liouville representation, then it must commute with R star tensor R for all element of SU2. So now we're going to use a trick. Now we know that for a rep of SU2, we have this nice relation that R star is actually unitarily related to R just by some rotation around the y-axis by 180 degrees. So it turned out that this condition, if I want to know what's the form of K, K chi, then instead of trying to solve this equation, I could just solve this one here for K prime zeta, where K prime is just related by a unitary to K. K zeta. So now, what I have to solve is just that K prime zeta commute with R tensor R. And this pretty much, it's well known what the solution of this is. The solution that it gave us is that R e reps of R tensor R are actually have actually multiplicity 1, and by using this property, actually they have multiplicity 1, and there's actually 2j plus 1 of them. And by Schur lemma, and by using the fact that multiplicity 1, we know that the form of k prime zeta must actually be a summation of projectors into the different, each of the projectors correspond to a different total angular momentum, where k go to 0 to 2j plus 1.
And the CK is can be any complex parameter. So what we just show is in the Louisville representation, there exists 2J plus 1 linearly independent matrix that can be used as a basis to write any covariant map. So any covariant map can be written using that as a basis. So now to finish your problem, to finish your proof, what we need to do is to find, is because the problem we have now is that those projectors, it's difficult to deduce from them the form of it's difficult from the Louisville representation in that form to go back in the Coase form and to obtain the result that we wanted, which is this form, right? So what we need to do is to find another basis of 2J plus 1 linear independent matrix that it's equivalent to this basis there, and that actually can give us back the form that we want. And how we do this is, well, we consider then the Louisville representation of our zeta map. So if we follow the rules that we put together, then the zeta on this map here can be written in the Louisville representation like this here. Right. Now, if I take a composition of the map zeta n time, then the map that I get in the Louisville representation is a power of n of the previous matrix that we have. So we just need, to finish your proof, we simply need to show that those matrix for n that goes to 0 to 2j are linearly independent. And to do this, it's not too hard. So the trick is you notice that the matrix that we're interested in is the power of this matrix here. We see that it's unitarily related to this matrix there we have. So they must have the same number of distinct eigen values. Now, this matrix is actually just equal. It's related to the total angular momentum operator minus some the identity operator here by this simple equation here. But we know that this operator, the total angular momentum operator, has 2j plus 1 distinct eigen values. So it must say that this matrix has 2j plus 1 distinct eigen values, which tells us that this matrix has 2j plus 1 distinct eigen values. And we just use the fundamental theorem of algebra, and it tells us that, well, those matrix must be actually linearly independent because they have the power of a matrix that has 2j plus 1 linearly independent eigen values. If you take n power of it plus the identity matrix, they must be linearly independent. Okay, so we actually showed that every covariant matrix can be written in that form, and if you can write a any covariant map can be written in that form, and that any map that is written in that form is also covariant. But from the proof we put, the Qn could be complex. It turned out that in fact they're restricted to reals. But to prove they're reals, you can do it by induction, and just using the fact that the map is positive.
Maps, interesting to ask, all maps was close and pretty close.
But I mean, it is related. Yeah,
but I wonder if it's exactly the same. What is the cost for those things?
The cross operator?
I think you're taking up the map which averages over the group. If you take the map which averages over the group, then things that commute with the representation of the group will be noiseless relative to that twirling map. But what he's doing is representing any map which is covariant under the group.
I understand that it looks like the form it has seems to be the stable form of any map which actually gives us a balance. I'm not sure.
It will leave all the invariant states invariant.
Oh, that?
Yes.
Yes, we'll leave all the invariant states.
So it should invariant all the states which are invariant in the rotation?
Yes. So you say that there's a form in this?
Well, I would like to look like that.
Okay, so there is actually like a question related to this. The first one is so this is true for SU2. What happens if you use orderly group? Right, so what we have found is a theorem that we give a representation of a covariant map under some Lie group, and we get a representation in function of the generators of the Lie algebra. So what can you say for other Lie group? Is there any if you have a map that's covariant over a representation over other Lie group, can you write it in function of the Lie algebra generator in a similar form? And there are restrictions. There is also actually, like I said, the QN on rails, but there's actually more restriction to them because the map must be completely positive. So might be interesting to know what are those restrictions. Okay, now let's talk about the dynamics of a quantum directional reference frame. So what do I mean by a quantum directional reference frame? Classically, what you have when you want to do some operation is suppose you want to do a gate. Suppose you want to perform a rotation around some axis on a qubit. Well, you need that somebody give you some direction in space, so that you can know around which axis you rotate. Now, quantumly, it would be interesting to know, like, suppose that you have a state that's restricted to some finite dimensional Hilbert space, and that you want to use the information contained in that state to do such operation, like a rotation around some axis on other states. How good can you actually do that? Because if you're not that, the fact that the quantum reference frame is a quantum state, you cannot perform certain operation with without errors. And every time you use it to do so, the state of the quantum reference frame change. So it will be interesting to know like how this state actually involves. Like on certain condition. So here's this, like the kind of states I'm considering. So let's consider a spin J. I will write the zero here just to say that's my initial states.
Okay. So the index there is going to say like how many times I actually use that as space. So I will suppose that that nice states here, my spin j, only depends on a classical direction given by n. Then if r, okay, is a rotation that runs from n at to n at prime, then I have this condition that the state of my quantum reference frame after the rotation should be equal to the state of my quantum reference frame if the classical reference frame was pointing in the n at prime direction. So using this condition, then we know that rho j 0 must be it's invariant under rotation about the n-hat axis. So therefore, the states, I can restrict myself to say that rho j 0 is actually diagonal in the basis that consists of the eigenvectors of the operator g n prime. So this is the angular momentum in the n in that direction.
Okay. Would you like to give an example for spinning a half?
For spinning one half? Okay, so a quantum reference frame of spinning one half you just say that a spin one half, you can usually write it in this basis, right? So this corresponds to the eigenvalue to the total angular momentum, which is one half, and this is the eigenvectors. The eigenvalue. For let's say the g n hat operator. So since you heard that suppose that the classical reference frame is in the z direction. So that's a state that you have. And this is just if nz is 1/2 or -1/2, right? So what I'm saying here is just that the quantum reference frame is in the n at direction, then if I define this as being as two eigenvectors of this operator, then my states can always be written in a mixture of those two states. This is just my claim. Okay. So this can generalize to other dimension. Okay, so here's the scenario I'm considering it. So I have a quantum reference frame. Okay, so I start with that space here. And I also have a reservoir. So the reservoir is composed of many subsystems. Each of the subsystems of dimension d. Now my condition is that each of those subsystems are in the same state as the other, and they're not correlated. Then what I do is I apply a map. So chi can be chosen every term. All my quantum reference frame, and let's say on the first subsystem, and then under that operation, I get the new states for my quantum reference frame, okay? Which is given by the action of the map see on the project on the states, which is actually just a trace of this states when you trace the somewhat. So, like physically, what I'm doing is apply a map on one of the subsystems of the reservoir, the polynomial reference frame, and I discard the reservoir.
Sorry, are there systems in identical states as well as, when you say identical subsystems, do you mean 1, 2, 3 are all in identical states as well?
Oh, I mean they are ordered, but they all have the same states.
But don't you want this tied to be rotationally invariant?
Yes, okay. Yes. To be interesting. Well, I mean, actually, I want this to be rotationally invariant. One assumption we can suppose is that this is actually rotationally invariant, and that the subsystem is rotationally invariant. So this is a big restriction, but it's interesting in some meaning situation. Okay,
I'm not sure I should answer this question. Each state you can become.
No, each state is the same. Oh. I'm considering this scenario.
Okay.
Technically, you will not have to, but it's if you want to calculate something, like the dynamics of what happened after you use many times, you have to have some structure on the states.
So, you're interested in large N, I'm guessing?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm also interested in small n, actually. That's the point. So that's the point of all this work. But
so can you maybe help me understand this a little bit by, let's consider the case where d equals j, or 2j plus 1.
Okay.
And I is just a unitary on a bigger space, and then trace it out.
Okay.
What class of maps can I get through that operation?
So it depends, it really depends on your state there. So you say you're just giving dimension, right? But it depends on the form of the states that it has. But it, there's a lot of things it could be. But it really depends on, okay. I'm going to give you some example. Later, so maybe you will understand.
Okay, that's fine.
Because I don't have a general class of math. Actually, but I know there's non-trivial situation.
Okay.
That I'm gonna give you. Okay. So now the trick was just to continue like this. So I use the new quantum reference frame that I have. I use the next subsystem. And then I apply the same map, and then I trace down the reservoir again. And then I do this many times. Now I'm going to be interested in to define some quantity of interest for an experimentalist, and say how those quantity of interest involve the time, involve with the number of years of the map guy. Okay, so the extra assumption I'm going to do is because what I want to do is just that the map that's acting on the quantum reference frame is covariant. So one sufficient assumption is just that chi is rotationally invariant. And that the state of the system as well is also invariant under space rotation.
Just a comment. The second one looks like a restriction. But the first one doesn't seem like a restriction. It seems to be the whole meaning of the reference frame.
Yes, I do agree. But meaningfully it is, but you can be interested in an experimentalist that do something really weird, right? So you use you could suppose that the Hamiltonian depends on some direction in space, right? And you use it to win a quantum directional reference frame to apply some transformation on the states. I mean, you could imagine a situation like this, and in that case, then chi will not be potentially invariant. To rule out. That's why I have to. Okay, so one thing that this
That means that the experimenter has another reference point, at least at some level of approximation.
Yes, but you can always use an Newtonian, even if he has a chrome reference frame, you can always use an invariant Newtonian.
No, not like if the Hamiltonian is dependent on the space or something, then it means the experimenter has access to another reference.
Yes, but suppose
you should probably be including that in your reference.
Yes, but you could, okay, I do agree, but you have to think about a precise experiment. Suppose that you have a qubit, you want to do a transformation, but the Hamiltonian you're using is, you want to do it quite fast. I don't know, you have a big quantum computer, all your devices are pretty close, you want to do your thing, but now the information about the rotation on the in which the axis you want to do is just restrict. It's just a quantum state that's actually quite small. So you want to do how good a portion you can do. Now there is many imperfection in the device, everything that might make this thing not potentially invariant. But I mean, so suppose it is potentially invariant.
I thought that perhaps might be an example that's useful here. If you have one spin or two spins being a direction indicator, then you can imagine, and your task is to rotate about that direction. Mm-hmm. You can do a controlled unitary. But something else you could do is you could take your classical reference frame in the lab, measure the direction of this sample you've had relative to it, and then rotate relative to it. And I think the effective operation there each outcome corresponds to a non-invariant operation, but you're still somehow using your quantum reference frame. Does that help?
Yeah, I mean, it's just a question of why you call it a reference frame. So.
But it really depends on, you have to look at the certain situation, and you have to look at the condition. But what I'm saying is, it's true,
certainly you have something else that amounts to a full or partial reference frame. You can do it instead. So, yeah, I don't think there's that. I'm not disagreeing with anything. I guess it's just a question of what the application you have in mind
is. Yeah. But it really depends on the person that wants to use my results.
Yeah, in fact, at some point, if you didn't do it before, I'd be interested to see some practical or some theorem that which of these rotationally invariant maps can you actually realize, and how would you realize them?
I'm going to have my shared discussion about this. Yeah. Maybe it's going to make it full year.
No, I'm not saying to do it now, obviously. It would be nice at some point.
So one of the important points, the implication of the fact that XZMAP is actually a rotation invariant is that all the quantum reference frame states after key use still going to be diagonal in the basis of the Eigen vectors given by the operator by this operator. Okay, so it's always going to be diagonal in the same basis. Okay, so I just want to mention quickly two important papers related to this work. Previously, some people considered a similar situation. However, the case in the case they were considering is that they considered, for example, chi just to be a measurement. Well, like in this work, we're actually generalizing to any covariant map. The other thing is they actually consider only the case D is equal to 2, which is actually become more very different when you go to higher dimension. And they also fix what they call the quality. What I actually tried to give a definition of it is what we could call the quality function. So what is I mean by quality function?
I mean that it's any function f that could be used to quantify the average temperature of a string to perform a perturbative task. This is extremely general. Now, there is some restriction about this map. And one of the restrictions, well, actually, the restriction that there is on this map, on this function, is that it cannot depend on the direction of the classical reference frame for which the quantum reference frame adds information about. Okay, I mean, and this implies that this quality function can only depend on the eigenvalues of the quantum directional reference frame. Now, there's a different set of parameters that are equivalent to the eigenvalues of the quantum reference frame. And it's the moments. And how we define the moments is just like this equation here. So it's really some sort of the expectation of this the L power of this operator. So there is actually there's two J moments. And the reason is because there's not 2j plus 1, just because like the eigenvalues as the sum must be 1, so just because of this restriction. Now, any quality function depends only on those parameters there. And if I want to analyze any quality function, the only thing I have to do is to analyze all those moments involved with the use of the quantum reference frame. So it's not too hard to prove. Actually, it follows from the theorem I showed the first part of the talk. But there's another way of proving this. It's not too hard. Is that after the case step, the L moment of your quantum reference frame depend linearly on the moments of the previous quantum reference, or the quantum reference frame in the previous step. On some parameters. So, a second theorem that I was interested in is to restrict the number of those coefficients. So, it turned out that it follows from theorem one. And by using induction in some commutative relation, that those moments, for example, the L moments does not depend on moments that are higher than L. And if L is odd, then it depends only on odd moments. And if L is even, then it only depends on even moments. So it's quite simplified, the equation. Now, there was this theorem too can be used to prove another theorem about longevity. But what do we mean by longevity? So there was some interest about what's the scaling with respect to the dimension of your quantum reference frame, or how many times this quantum reference frame could be used to perform some task before the quality function f fall below a certain threshold.
And it was like classically it's a little bit philosophical, but like it quantumly I don't have, maybe Rob can help me on that one, but it's the J square, the fact that the scaling depend on J square, it's really a quantum feature that like it's would be hard to just guess like this. And because we consider any quality function, and that the longevity of the quantum reference frame can be quite arbitrary, then the only statement we can do is on the moments. Okay, so here's a theorem 3 about longevity. Is that suppose that I have some I start with some quantum reference frame. The state of the quantum reference frame can depend on J. Okay, so what I do is I'm going to consider different Hilbert space. So I start with a small dimension and increase the dimension. For each of the dimension, I consider an initial quantum reference frame. I consider each time I increase the dimension, I consider a new joint operation chi that I'm going to act on the quantum reference frame and on the reservoir. So for each of those dimensions, I get a back action map on the, that's restricted on the quantum reference frame. And now, if those things that I define follow some those conditions here, I'm gonna explain you physically what they mean. Then the moment scale like the order of J squared. And the first condition here, physically, it's not equivalent, but it's implied by the fact that the map is conserve angular momentum. The second condition here is just that the on the back action map, the Qn coefficient they do converge. And the third condition here. It's just that when you choose an arbitrary initial quantum reference frame, you just choose it so that the expectation value with the L moment, it's L, it's the order of J to the L.
So I think you just answered my question. I was going to ask, presumably you assume that you have a family of states. For every J, you have a certain state of some resemblance to the state. So that third constraint is...
It's about the initial states that you start with.
Right. Now, how do you ensure that you have a natural family of chi's? You wouldn't want, as you change the J value, to have the nature of chi change.
So the disturbance map is defined by the chi j. It turned out that if you show that those the coefficients that are defined by actually the chi j that you choose, but it actually depends on two things. It depends on the state attack of the reservoir and on the chi j. Okay, but I'm fixing the state of the reservoir, right? And I'm increasing the dimension of my reference frame. So basically, those parameters just depends on the form of the chi j. So here, my condition 2 is really on chi j.
But neither condition 1 nor condition 2 depends on j. Like if n max, for instance, was...
No, I'm sorry. I mean, this condition, it's... If you write qn the fraction of two polynomials in J, then the degree of the numerator is equal or smaller than the degree of the denominator. That's what actually this mathematically what it is. And
maybe I'll ask later.
But it's on the form. It's just to say it's restrict the kind of form of single J that you can have.
And the proof of this is followed from theorem from the previous theorem that I gave. Okay, so let's start with an example that's been studied before. Maybe that's gonna answer some question. So suppose that I have a reservoir that consists of spin 1/2, sort of a mini spin 1/2. But each spin is either parallel or anti-parallel to a direction n hat. And they're both parallel or anti-parallel with the same probability. Then the goal is to use the quantum reference frame to guess the direction of the spin one off. The best measurement that you can do by using this quantum reference frame, it's a projection into the two subspace that correspond to the total angular momentum of the quantum reference frame in one subsystem of the reservoir.
First thing, do you mean that it's just a unit matrix, its density matrix is the unit matrix? The very first one.
The density matrix
of the spin of the reservoir spin and a half system.
Yes, this is in the identity, yes. But it's turned out to be important that to calculate your probability of success to guess if it's really parallel or anti-parallel, then the state must be either parallel or anti-parallel, right? But the global state is right? So I define my quality function, as I just said, is my probability of guessing if it was parallel or anti-parallel. And by using this optimal measurement, it turned out to be just that's the projection into the J plus one half or J minus one half space. And the guess if it was up or down. So if you project it into J plus one half, you guess it's up. And if you project it into J minus one half, you guess it's down. And you can show that this fidelity function, the equation I just gave, just depends on the first moment of the quantum reference frame. You can use theorem 2, you can calculate like two equations, you can calculate how fast it indicates. So now this was already studied. But we could generalize this pretty easily just to arbitrary spin. Well, let's say it could be hard to calculate it if the spin was high. But for spin 1, for example, then you can also say that, okay, I have a spin, the reservoir is composed of spin 1, which is either related, like, compared to the direction n hat, it's either in the angular momentum of your spin one off is either 1, minus 1, or 0 with respect to that direction. And you want to know if you can use a quantum reference frame to guess the angular momentum of that spin. Then you can show that the optimal observed measurement is also projection into the different subspace that correspond to the total angular momentum. And you have a similar equation. And you can again use theorem 2 and express your quantity function of the moments. But in this example, the quantity function depends on the first and the second moment. So but you can actually calculate really easily by using theorem 2 with the coefficient R, and you know how they indicate. Okay, let's throw out a more interesting example. The pulley, suppose that you want to use the quantum reference frame to perform a rotation around an axis. Let's say a phase gate, here for simplicity. So if your quantum reference frame is in a finite Hilbert space, then you cannot do it without errors. So as a quality function, it has been proposed to use what we call the gate fidelity. So this tells you how good you can actually perform some gates on a qubit. Okay, so actually, what I want to perform is a phase gate on qubits. So my reservoir is composed of of qubits, and I suppose that they're all in the maximum unique states. So if you look at what the fidelity gate is, it's just the integral over the trace square of the cross operator of the approximate gate that you're going to perform using the chi equation that we talked about, compared with the gate that we would like to perform. So here's different method to actually implement the gate that might or might not be more interesting for an experimental. Now the third situation might be actually more interesting. But let's start by going naively and check what could I do? So yeah, it's I'm gonna try to finish in the next few minutes.
So suppose that you take the quantum reference frame and that you make a measurement that corresponds to this POVM here. So what this POVM here is, you get a state, let's say the GG state, and you take all the possible rotation of that state in space. You get some continuous POVM. Okay, so suppose that you can perform this measurement and get an approximate classical direction of your quantum reference frame just by one measurement. And then what you do is you take you use that axis, classical axis, to perform the rotation. Okay, so then you get some gate fidelity. Okay, so that's one thing you could do. If I use this in the scenario I explained earlier, I will, every time I introduce a new qubit, I will have to discard the result I got and reapply the POVM on my quantum reference frame. Okay, but experimentally, obviously, you do it once and you use the same guess all the time. But anyway, we're gonna have graphs just seeing the different fidelity decays. Okay, so another thing that might seem to be better intuitively is to perform a linear operation that corresponds actually to the POVM we just talked about, but done perform currently. So if you look at this this linear operation, what you do is you project the quantum reference frame into one GG state, but in one rotation, in one axis that depends on the rotation I integrate over. So I integrate over all possible rotation. And then I perform currently the phase gate in that direction. Okay. It turned out that this linear operation is not unitary, and just can be written as the difference between those two projections into the J plus one and the J minus one total angular momentum space. So that look close to a phase gate, right? And two different subspace. Now, well, if we can do this, actually, we might be interested to do it unitarily, right? So instead of performing that linear operation, why not doing this one, which is unitary, which is look closer to a phase gate? This one has the advantage to be, you could be implemented it, just if you add coupling between your quantum reference frame and each spin of your reservoir. So you can use that coupling to actually perform this. Now, if you look at the decays of the different methods, the fidelity. If you just make a measurement of, I guess, of the best direction with the first POVM I gave you, the fidelity is just giving here by this point. Now, the last method I talked to you actually give the best fidelity. So to calculate this, you just use theorem 2 and some simple calculation. So the important point here is that we can actually use like the theorem, like to compare the different fidelities, the different technique to implement the gates. And you can find out which method is that you think actually is better. I'm gonna skip this. It's just to say that the theorem 3 actually give as predicted the G square factors. So I'm gonna conclude. So what did I did was to generalize the concept of quality function and introduce the moment of a quantum reference frame. I gave recursive equations to find how the moments involve. Derive sufficient condition for observing the scaling of order J square for the longevity of quantum reference frame. And finally, I just gave like the two examples, the example I gave you at the end. So thank you. I just would like to thank the Perimeter Institute, the University of Sydney, and Ralph Spicken just for giving me the opportunity to go actually in Australia to start working on this project. And also for Thierry Rudolph, because he gave us some insight on to show how the parameters are actually real, the QN.
So any questions for Jason?
Yes.
I have a question. So I know that it's a finite, there are only a finite number of moments, but can you sort of compactify that whole thing, write down a characteristic function, like an exponential, like you do with probability?
Okay, maybe, but I don't know. But maybe.
Just a comment, or I wonder if there's some connection between this order of J squared scaling and ideas from non-commutative geometry. So, you know, you have this fuzzy sphere, as they call it, which is, can be actually, in some cases, identified with the sort of classical, I mean, it can identify with the spin J system in some cases. In fact, probably in all cases, and there, the sphere is like a little phase space, and the number of, I mean, you think of it as a kind of curved phase space, and then the cells in phase space are of some fixed size, and the area of the sphere is J squared. So it just, see, it sounds similar. It's just a suggestion. I don't know whether it would work, but has anyone thought of something like that, or? And if not, do you have some intuitive idea of where this order of J squared scaling comes from? I mean, the suggestion here was that the sphere has an area of J squared, the unit cell, that's a space case. The unit cell is of H squared, you know, unit cell is of size 1. So the number of different cells available to you is J squared, basically.
Yeah, but there might be something there. So John Gerard and they just say, like this. This degradation of quantum reference frame, just a walk, just a random walk. So that factor of 2 just actually just follows from the square root in the expectation. But the point is it's not exactly a random walk. It's more like a sphere. So your insight is probably closer to what is actually really happening. So
it's also a bit by partly your
senses.
Yes.
Yes.
But kind of
random.
Yes.
So this would be an actual quantum effect, like you were saying, okay? Then the walk sounds like a classic. I mean, I'm not saying it's necessarily a wrong insight, but the non-commutative geometry idea is that the sphere itself is a quantum object. And it's like a delta P and a delta Q. It's like if you're near the North Pole, say with J, Z, J being totally in the Z direction, then JX and JY have a commutation relation, which is not trivial. The magnitude of the deviation, like in the other talk, the magnitude of the deviation was proportional to JZ. So that gives a kind of geometrical way of thinking about non-commutative coordinates on this sphere. And that, so then, because they're non-commutative, there's a number of cells of phase space, so to speak. And that number scales like J squared. So I'm just wondering whether that scaling would be related.
Other questions? Okay, well, let's thank JC again.